Good afternoon. I want to have some fun today, and I want to start out by sharing a couple things at a high level. First, how appreciative I am and Elanco is to have the opportunity to be here, be members, and be involved in this organization. And I want to also kind of start out by saying that this industry, and I'm going to get extremely personal very quick, I believe strongly that this industry, the meat industry in this country, the U.S., is absolutely, to me, the best at what we do. I believe that we're in a very, very critical time now, not 2013, but I think an era that is a period I'm going to talk about in the next 20 years, and we've got a job to do. So I want to say right up front, I saw a recent statistic in the Wall Street Journal that conferences are becoming less effective. Over 92% won't take much away, and in 4 days, it'll be wasted. The majority of the value of the conference happens outside of the room, not in the room. And it's the relationships and the connections. And that typically the binders and the information you can get lost in. So I'm going to try to, hearing that, break a little bit of the statistics, and I'm going to say right now, right up front, that this is very personal to me. And I'm going to try right out of the gate to say why I think maybe that topic on that slide looks a little too fluffy for the here and the now. I'm losing dollars per head right now. Times are tough. We're in a cyclical industry. I'm going to try to connect right up front. And I'm going to start by telling a quick story that kind of converted me, and some of you may have heard this story from me before, so be like my kids on Thanksgiving. When my dad comes, and as he's pulling into the town, I usually huddle him around the table, all six kids, and say, "Papa's coming." And when he tells the stories that he's told before, act like you've never heard them before. So that's what I'm going to ask you to do if you've heard a few things that I've said. But I will tell you, I had a conversion about 6 years ago. I went to Cornell. I'm a grape farmer and dairy farmer from upstate New York and still in that business and still send money every month home to farm from Indiana where I live. And I went to Cornell. But 6 years ago, after being with Elanco for quite some time, I sat in a large room at Harvard with about 300 people. And what I would tell you is after about 4 hours, I quickly understood that the majority of that room that day didn't like what we do. And quickly, I understood that meat was something that shouldn't be consumed, and meat was causing diseases, and meat's bad for the environment, and my blood pressure went off the charts in the first 3 hours. And then the best thing that ever happened to me, and I don't even know, you know, God kind of had an impact on me, and I kind of had a balcony moment, and it hit me that, hey, look at these people. Forget about what they're saying. Look at them. They personally believe what they're saying. And they also are not embarrassed to say it. And they do believe they can make a difference personally. And I wrote something on a yellow scratch pad. I remember it's in a photograph of my mind. I wrote right on the top of that day, activist. I got on the next plane the next morning, flew back to Indianapolis, went to the parent company headquarters, went to the top floor, walked into my boss, the head of Eli Lilly Pharmaceutical Company, and out of a kind of an analogy, I took my keys and I threw them on the desk and I said, if you want to run Elanco, go ahead. If you want somebody else to. Because I'm done being politically correct. I'm done staying in certain corners when we got to get out of those corners. There's as much of a moral imperative here as there is as an economic opportunity in running a business. Sure, we work for a public company. Sure, we got to do certain things. But it's time, candidly, to speak up for what we do. So what I'm about to share is in that context. This is not an Elanco message. This is not a politically correct message. I'm not expecting you, candidly, to agree with everything I've said. I got three goals. I got three goals that I hope come through here. Is at a personal level, maybe on that scratch pad in front of you. I'm talking to the experts. If I talk about consumer and brand and, oh, come on. I'm a student. You're the professors. So please, don't take anything in context. I am learning. We are learning as a company. So please, Don't take it in that context. Here's what I'm attempting to do in the next few minutes. Is one, is I just want to resharpen that edge. I think the word of the future I'll talk about in the next 10 years, the last 10 years might have been about the what and the how. I think the next 10 years in business and especially food and agriculture is about the why. What is your why? What's your reason right now to lead? Two is ideas. What are the opportunities? What are the opportunities maybe in a little bigger context? And I'll highlight here in just a minute. I think there's three things that we need to be thinking about that can make our companies not just more money, but put us in a stronger position as a U.S. meat industry in the next few years. So what are the opportunities? Maybe that's something you jot down on the white pad and break that Wall Street statistic. Or the last is just something that a common thing we do in our company is, hey, what are you going to start, stop, or keep? Is there something you're going to do more of? Is there something you're going to start or stop? So that's the journey. I'm not going to show a lot of data. I'm going to show a lot of pictures. I'm going to get into a few juicy topics. And the goal here is hopefully to come back at the end to say, hey, I believe a little bit more. There's a reason people go to church on Sunday or huddle around people at a coffee shop to get energized. And my goal, too, is part of this is a little emotional. I think the next couple years in the meat industry is going to be just as much about our heart and our conviction as it is about our head. That's Jeff Simmons' opinion. And it's all about we have to be more competitive tomorrow than we are today. And I don't know what that scorecard is, if that's dollars per head, or that's changing the brand, or that's exporting, or that's, you know, beating another protein or another country, but ultimately that's ultimately what will make us say in 5 years I'll still be in this room. So that's the goal today, and I apologize and give my disclaimer right now. Not an expert. Goal is to be personal, and goal is to not be a Wall Street Journal statistic. So I was thinking a little bit about this over the weekend. Had a pretty interesting week last week in the meat industry on a lot of fronts, and I was up in Canada speaking with the Canadian beef industry, and on the way back thinking about being here with the top leaders in the top country and what I think is the most important industry in our future, and thinking, oh my goodness, global food security, U.S. meat industry. Knowing a lot of you in the room, you're probably thinking, oh, come on, we don't have time for this fluffy up in the clouds talk right now. We're here and now. Well, here's my three, what I would say, things going on in the world from my seat that say, if I was running a meat company, and our job as a Landco and other partners here is to enable you, here's the three trends that I think are absolutely, absolutely significant. One, I challenged with a question mark tweeting this morning to say, what is the one trend in the next 20 years that will be our greatest opportunity? There's something that's going to happen in the next 20 years that's never happened in the history of man that's going to impact the meat industry, and that's the middle class. Middle class, I talked to one of the largest economist groups in the world last week, and they claimed this. I was in Asia in January. Everyone is this has now become a reality. The middle class will grow faster in the next 20 years than any time in the history of man. And the first thing that happens when you become middle class, and in Asia that's $5 a day, the first thing that happens is people start moving off from rice and beans to meat, milk, and eggs. And that's the first thing. And some people, even here in the United States, and I'll say I sat around a table recently with six housewives in Indianapolis, I'll talk about four blocks from our headquarters, that are struggling to give their kids meat, milk, and eggs. It isn't rice and beans, candidly to them. It's chips and soda because they're the cheapest calories they can buy at the Walgreens. That is the only grocery store that they can afford to get to. This is a big deal. Two is global volatility. There's never been a time we're more connected. You know this better than me, but supply, demand, and margins, and chasing margins, whether that's around the world or that's in a different category, I had to share with our public board the corn price when we started our five-year plan in 2007 and where it was at the end of our five-year plan in 2012 and what that meant. They wanted to know what did it mean, the president of UPS and McDonald's and caterpillar that's on the lily board, tell us what that means, that 3x difference in feed costs. I think this shift is going to be the new normal. And lastly is brands. I will just say, some people say, hey, we're in a commodity business. I think that first point on middle class, there is more and more of a demand for brands. And I'll give it three contexts. One, Eli Lilly, I sit on the board and the executive officers with the six largest pharmaceutical company. And I will tell you, what does somebody want in the middle class from Sioux Falls to Singapore or Shanghai is a branded product. The other one is I sit on the Chiquita Brands board, largest banana and salad company. Brands have never mattered more. I'm kind of surprised about whether it's the blue sticker of Chiquita or Fresh Express salad or putting a retail brand on it. Branding matters. So I think what's happening in our world, what I'm going to talk about here, I think these are the three trends that say this is where there's opportunity. There's also risk if we don't get a hold of these trends, because somebody will. Here's a couple pictures of this. You might not be able to see this. We'll make these slides available, but this is the shifting middle class. Again, I spent about 10 days in Asia in January, and it shocked me that, hey, in the Indonesias, in the Vietnams, in the Cambodias, it is absolutely, we're going to go from 500 million people to 3 billion people in the middle class. And what I'll say now, and some people see this, is middle class is defined differently in the United States versus Asia. But what I would tell you is there are some shifts and some trends here. And whether you're an exporter or not, this is a real world phenomenon that's going to impact us more than ever in the next 20 years. The other is, I believe these three numbers are the most critical numbers for our business. This is what I put on a napkin when I go back to my hometown in the coffee shop is, so what do you mean? And I'm saying, hey, we're living between the 7 and the 9. A year ago, we got 7 billion people. Whether you like it or not, this is when we were put on this earth, and we are going to live between 7 and 9 billion people. The 9 billion will likely happen before 2050. And population is going backwards right now in Japan and in Italy and in France, and it will likely go backwards in China in this window of time or shortly after. But during this, so this may not be an infinite problem, but for us, in the next 25 years, this is our, I believe, opportunity and responsibility. But the middle number is what nobody's talking about. I got a chance to go sit and speak at the G8 last year, and I say the meeting started at 8 a.m. Some of you may have been there, and this really upset me. And after listening to many politicians and the Gates Foundation and Bono and all the way through, it was 2:30 before someone mentioned the M word, meat, milk or eggs, grains and Africa and trade. But here's the issue. The 3 billion people in the middle in this growth are the people coming on to meat, milk and eggs for the first time. And whether this is your day-to-day business, this is a reality. And this is a reason if I say anything. And what I say to our new millennials working in our company is, if we're going to be an innovator in meat, milk, and eggs, and there's 3 billion people, you don't be embarrassed on an airplane on what you do. Because this is, and I thought Bill Gates gave the best answer on a program I was on once when someone said, well, maybe we should convince them not to eat meat. And his answer was, that's not our job. Our job is to make sure that we provide people what they want, when they want it, using the least amount of environment in the most affordable, safe way. And I thought, well, the heck with my public affairs department. I'm using that as my new verbatim and quoting him every time. I think this is a big deal. 7 to 9 plus 3 is 2050. And that's, to me, an opportunity. And I think that's a way to gravitate new employees to your company as well, as there's nothing bigger and better. Another one is this, I'm not going to get into all this now, but animal-based protein diets matter. We're planning to release quite a bit of information on this. We're going to write a couple white papers, work with some people in this room here to really promote that cognitive skills have improved. There's a Kenya study. There's different studies around the world. There's studies I know that even some of your companies have done to show when you eat an animal-based diet, many things change, from the size of bodies to cognitive skills. And I don't think this is something that we get on the defense, but we get on the offense. And we share data that maybe in the past we were scared to share. So, this slide, I put your logos on it, but this is the slide we showed at 30 universities. as we followed Michael Pollan and others around to say, hold it just a minute. Anyone, we tried to go into, I spoke at Beijing University, and we've gone to all the land grants, is to say, this is the time to, one, if you're in agriculture and food, be proud of what you do. If you're in engineering, energy, information, you're probably in the wrong place, unless it has a connection. This is the hottest industry the next 20 to 30 years, because feeding this world, dealing with all the complexities you deal with, this is a reality. And so we've finally made it to the cover of the paper, the front page. And I think the challenge is now we've got to play offense. And many of you are doing that. I'll just share, I share this slide only from the standpoint, this is not an Elanco presentation, I'm not talking products, but this is the slide that changed our company. We got tired of being laughed at inside a large Fortune 100 company, and we weren't getting invested in. And this was a slide we used in 2007 in front of our public board to say, we are not in the animal business. We are in the people business. 90% of our business is to your left. And that is, we are in the food business. We make food more affordable, healthy, and safe. And we do that through customers that are in this room. And that is our job. And candidly, and we got this joke was common in Eli Lilly. The only difference between Lilly Pharmaceuticals and Elanco is Elanco eats its customers. And I got tired of the laughing and said, no. Candidly, we take care of the number one health problem. And candidly, your darn drugs don't work if someone doesn't have proper nutrition. I'm not talking about the UNICEF hunger situation. I'm talking about people four blocks from our headquarters, 8 out of 10 people in Indianapolis that are counting on a free lunch and a free breakfast at the public school system to eat. Making food more affordable makes your drugs work. So we're number one in the category. We went on the offense, and we weren't politically correct. And what I would say is we've had more investment in our business the last 5 years than the other four businesses. And so my challenge is I think we got to continue to, I think, sell to not just our investors, but to our employees and everybody that this is the right place to be. So let me end with one last concept, and then I'll get to the meat of the presentation. This is something that I just will share because I really believe that as you travel around in our industry, it's hard. This is a hard business. It's hard not to think about the day-to-day volatility and the margins. Talked to a lot of customers last week on the phone, and you can feel the urgency of 4 o'clock, not of even tomorrow. And so one of my challenges stepping back and maybe giving us a chance here on a Sunday to step back is to say, I believe this concept that's pretty basic is candidly, as you study the best companies, maybe the concept that will differentiate, because many strategies are the same, execution, good people, got to export, got to import. To me, this is what I see great companies doing. And it's this simple concept that is most companies that are conventional kind of start from the outside in. And they talk about what they produce and how they produce it and pretty much say, hey, would you like to buy one? Simon Sinek, the man that's out promoting this concept, used Gateway versus Apple. And, hey, we make good computers. We do it with great science and great technology. Would you like to buy one? The non-conventional companies. There's food companies that are doing this. There's Apple Computer. There's Tom's Shoes. The why is becoming a bigger perspective. Apple turns it around and says, we create the most innovative culture possible to create solutions that are fun, that makes your life easy. And, oh, yeah, we do make computers and iPads, and would you like one? But they don't talk about products as much as the absolute concept first. And this has made a few things become a reality. Not only employees, but this concept of people and customers want to do business more with companies, why they do what they do, not what. So we've asked our employees to do two things. All 3,000 of them, stand behind a camera and tell us, why do you do what you do? I don't want you to have talking points on an airplane when someone asks you. And number two, take a half a day every quarter with your family, with your teenage daughter, and go see a hungry face. Go feed somebody on Elanco's time. I think the why in this industry has got to be as part of our soul as much as anything else. If not, I think this can not only wear us down, but two is I think this is not a time that we have to worry about just talking points and being politically correct. So, and I think these are the things that a why does. It makes the impossible possible. It makes customers become more attracted. And I think a personal conviction, you no longer need to worry about work-life balance. A convicted person with a strong why. To this next generation, I'm learning. I have two 20-year-olds that are mentoring me right now. And what they say is there's not work in life. It's life. And that's why we want purpose. Money matters, but there's a lot of other things that matter too. And what I've learned is, you know what? These aren't just employees. These are a lot of the consumers that you're trying to serve. And understanding this is pretty important, especially in the space that I think we're in. So get out of our bubble. I won't spend a lot of time here. I want to get in, but I'll just share that I had a chance I try to use about half my vacation and get out of my bubble. And I would say this is just one quick reflection, and that is I stood looking at this, at these buildings, and spent 5 days inside one of the worst slums in the world in Kibera, Kenya. And after fasting for 30 hours and living kind of amongst this, and I was pretty exhausted and ready, candidly, to get home. I stood at the top looking out at these buildings as far as you could see, and one of the greatest leaders I ever stood with, a very, very humble man, stood there looking out that actually leads a large organization there. And I said, this is uncomprehendable. And he said, Jeff, this is $2 a day living. I said, okay. He said, you ought to read your stuff because don't worry about the dying of hunger. $2 a day living's okay. It'll soon become $4 to $5 a day living. But you need to understand something. If 43% of the world lives on $2 a day, and one out of four tables in Europe and America are struggling to put food on their table, he said what's in the gray in the quote on the top. More live with food as an issue than those that don't. And those that don't live with food as an issue hold the keys to the success for those that do. And yeah, it took me to go to Kenya to stand and get exhausted and beat up and live in a slum with a bunch of 20-year-olds for 5 days to see this. But what I'll tell you is I have a lot more conviction about what we do and the next innovation and how can we help you make your product even more adaptable to consumers all over the world. So I think getting out of our bubble is pretty key. And I think there is a moral aspect to this, as Norman Borlaug said. I think it's anyone that's born having the right to food is something that I believe strongly in. Our playing field, you know what our playing field is, so just quickly in pictures, hunger is the number one health problem in the world by the World Health Organization. I don't worry so much about, and I find in audiences in America, talking about people dying of hunger is not something that connects 25,000 people a day. That's not something, but I do think this hidden hunger, the number of people that live not knowing when and where their next meal is going to come from, or the stages of hunger. Candidly, it goes from maybe the UNICEF Sudan situation all the way through to the mothers that I sat with in Eastern Indianapolis that say, the sickest thing, if you could have sat at this table and listened to what I listened to not long ago, to hear them say, the sickest thing as a mother is to look at your obese child and say, with my money, I can only get down to the Walgreens and the cheapest calories are a 2-liter can of soda and Fritos, and they go from hungry to the wrong calories, which leads to a lack of brain development, a struggle in school, and the absolute opposite of a body condition that I want. I think hidden hunger is as much of an issue as the real hunger, and it's here. So I don't think this is something that we need to back down. I think the other is just the reality of $7,000 is the average income on an annual basis. That's a reality. Population, as we know, is increasing. It will decrease, but we are adding a Los Angeles and a Chicago every month. This is a graphic that I've used a lot that was in Foreign Policy magazine last year that just talks about this growing movement to meat and the importance of being able to have enough meat in the right places in the world to be able to be there when that demand is there. And as I mentioned, I think there's a lot of data that shows, and there's a project here in Kenya, there's a few other studies that I showed earlier, but that meat has improved cognitive skills. There's a study that showed milk has improved the height and the weight, and I think this is something that probably needs to be communicated a little bit more, as there's a lot of countering information that is out there on this. The environmental impact, I will say, the area we probably, as a company ourselves, have avoided is this whole fact to say, what can we do? Today we are living on 1.25 of the world. And the World Wildlife Federation has said pretty clearly, we have to freeze, actually turn around the current trends, especially internationally. We have to turn around this trend, and this is absolutely critical. I also think that this is a story and a message. As I've said, I think you're going to see the next couple products that we may even come out with will actually have environmental claims more so than efficiency claims. I think, how do we convert our business to really look at this issue? Because what you do it as productively as anybody in the world. You have increased productivity. The top innovation in the world is American agriculture. 250% more meat, same resources. No industry's ever done that. Now you're being asked to do it again. With more regulation and more bureaucracy, I think this is our challenge. And yes, we've got public affairs issues, which we'll dig into here. So that's kind of the high level. And I always say this on the public affairs issues: every industry has them. It can be discouraging, but what I'll tell you is, sitting at a pharmaceutical company and looking at their external issues, and looking at a banana company, or looking at other industries, energy, what I would say is this: they have just as ugly of a windshield sometimes, but they don't have the tailwind that we have in terms of the need for what we do. So I kind of look at this as, this is just part of the world we live in and part of business. So, a food secure world in 2050, is it really possible? I think the answer is yes, it is. There's a lot of theories, and there's a lot of people that have ideas, from food waste to not eating meat to a lot of different perspectives. And I believe there's probably a top 10 list out there. I believe that these are the three leading solutions with, to me, the strongest merit to say a food secure world in 2050, a U.S. meat industry that can prosper and be one of the biggest parts of the solution. It will come back to these three simple things: innovation, choice, and trade. You need to innovate. You need to do things creatively. Two, you need to sustain choice. And three is, meat, milk, and eggs must move to feed this world. So let me just walk through the three of these, and then we'll definitely leave time for questions. So technology. Really, Jeff? Technology? Yes. FAO, WHO, Gates Foundation, everyone would conclude that 70 to 80%, World Wildlife Fund, 70 to 80% of the solution to add 70% more food has got to come from innovation. Innovation defined as better practices, better approaches, new creative ways, packaging, less waste. Second is genetics. Do it better. Crops, animals, genetics. Third is products. Coming up with the next thing that's better. Doesn't every industry solve its biggest problems with innovation? 70% of our solution for a food secure world in 2050 is going to come from innovation. I think the best read you can ever read right now in our business is the Gates Foundation letter. If you don't get that, you ought to get it. Every year he puts out a letter in January. It's about 20 pages. And what I'll tell you is, the last 3 years, the thread that runs through the last 3 years of the Gates letter: no independent organization spending more money right now in trying to solve social injustice, trying to solve poverty, and trying to solve hunger than the Gates Foundation. And ultimately, the conclusion is, farm productivity is the start of it all. When the farm becomes more productive, when production becomes more productive, everything else trickles in a positive way. Really, it's kind of this. This is, if you read kind of the letter and the approach, this is essentially it. I mean, it's how do we do it differently, more efficiently? That leads to efficiency, and that leads to affordability, and things change. Now, they're trying to do it around the world everywhere, but one of my arguments is, if we do it best here, here's our opportunity. I think this is three dimensions to technology, and let me just share briefly that We have a tendency to look at this in a two dimension, the two sides, not the bottom. So if you look at someone like us, we're always looking at the scientific. Is it valid? Is it verified? Is it right scientifically? Any inventor is looking at that side of it. For a lot of you that may receive an innovation, it's, can I make money with it? Otherwise, it's just a good idea. If I can make money with it, well, then it's economically viable. I think this third dimension that the Center of Food Integrity is brought in, I think is absolutely critical, and that is it ethically grounded? Meaning, if we lose an innovation, what's that mean? Are we going to use more environment? Or if we're not using something we should be using, that's maybe even putting a consumer risk, is that an issue? Are we needing two more cattle every 10 because of this? Bringing this ethical argument into the equation is something that inventors and innovators and companies haven't done a very good job of, and I think it's something as industries we haven't spoken much of. And I think this is something that is going to be critical for the long-term sustainability of innovation in food. I've already used this chart and talked about this, but someone always asks me, so what's the best innovation that could solve our problems? It's replicating our past, especially in American agriculture. And I'm sorry, nobody can do it better. Nobody can produce something with as high a quality, as affordable, and as safe. And I'll say that in Europe and Asia and everywhere else than you can in the meat industry in America. And this chart shows it. We have absolutely 2.5 times production on the same footprint. Show me any industry that has done that. And it's a lot of good leadership, a lot of good innovation. It's our job now. We got to replicate it again. I lived in Brazil. I lived in the UK. I had a son in both spots. I have 6 kids. Every time we moved to Elanco, we had a kid. So we stopped. My wife got the Suburban full, and she said, I'm not driving a Baptist van, Jeff. We're done. So we stopped moving on the 6th kid. It was worked. But we had a child in the UK, we had one in Brazil, and we had one in America. So I kind of almost feel like I have 3 passports in my home, so I can talk about these countries a little bit more openly. But candidly, I was in the UK during the foot and mouth disease 2000-2003 period and experienced agriculture. And here's a couple insights I had in the UK. One was, this is the history of a lot of innovation, a lot of genetics. You track back agriculture, animal agriculture. There were pioneers and some of the best innovations, genetically, technology. And what has happened in about a 12-year period in the UK is kind of a sad story. They've gone from a net food exporter, they were an innovation exporter too, to today you shut the borders of the UK off and they can't feed themselves. And you say why? A lot of politics, a lot of stories, a lot of white papers written. But what I can tell you is if you make a list of all the things they can and can't do in animal agriculture, from the country I lived in before the UK, Brazil, there's a vast difference between those two. The tools, the mechanisms, and now what I've seen happen is a mindset. I spoke in this last year in the UK on this, and there was controversy in the room, but most of the answers were, Jeff, that's what we've decided to do. We're a green country now. And my challenge is, what's the moral aspect? What's the ethical aspect that Brazil chicken or whatever is going into the UK when the UK could be feeding themselves and Brazil chicken could be going somewhere else or US chicken or whatever? I think there's an aspect to this. So I'm going to openly speak about it, that, you know, the statistics don't look very good. You can say, well, that's the UK. Well, I think a state proposition in the US or something that when a choice is taken away, we should be considering, what does this mean? So technology is under attack, no question. So I think we got to be careful that we get too PowerPointish and get too politically active. So I have a group that I use on a regular basis, and it's my wife's book club. Now I wait till they've had 2 glasses of wine, and then I come walking in to the living room with my wife's book club, and I try some things. And right around Christmas, I had an opportunity, and I got out an egg. And they said, you know, they always want to talk about different aspects of food. And I'll talk in a minute. We're big believers in choice. I know where our whole industry is. But I held up an egg and I said, you know, they said, oh, Jeff, what's new in the food business and meat and milk? And what's the next technology? A little fun. So I poured them their 3rd glass of wine. And then I lifted an egg out and I said, you know, let's keep it very simple. And I opened up by saying, egg, I know that in this kitchen right here, that on a special morning, it's, hey, Dad, can you make me a couple eggs? Mom, can you make me a couple eggs? This is a desire here in America, in suburbia, in our bubbles. And I also said in Kenya, with 70, 80 kids in this little packed in, and the same pastor, Fred, or whatever, says to me, this leader, he says, all these kids have never had an egg. They've never had a piece of meat. And talking to those mothers in Indianapolis, a desire for every parent is to be able to let their kids have a protein like an egg or a piece of meat that changes their well-being. An egg is a bridge protein. It's a bridge from rice and beans over to meat, milk, eggs, fish even. But egg is a bridge protein. It's 7 to 12 cents on average in a lot of countries. It changes the brain development of kids, which changes their education, which changes their job, which changes a community. But let me be very clear. Women, this is very clear, book club. There's less eggs today than there was 6 months ago. There's something going on in eggs that might start going on in other proteins. And that is that we are going backwards. We're not just keeping up with population, but we're losing about an egg and a half per hen globally per year. And so I was speaking last week, and a guy stood up and said, I was in a major retailer, a national retailer in Mexico. They were out of eggs at 2 o'clock. I was on the phone the other day with a top 5 retailer in the UK. I know the CEO very well, and he says, Jeff, on a regular basis, 3, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, we're out of eggs. The point is, there's something going on here. What's going on is disease continues. Policy continues. I won't get into the statistics here, but we're seeing still disease outbreaks. Mexico last year. We're seeing new practices on how to raise chickens that has impacted in some parts of the world productivity. And that's caused imports and exports to move. And we're seeing companies like Elanco actually walk away from ag and poultry innovation. And these three things have made this one of the worst stories on productivity. That we're actually not keeping pace with population, we're not keeping pace with last year. This is something that I think is an example. And I think we need to get back to telling stories with eggs versus PowerPoint slides. The last thing on technology I'll come back to is something we've learned, which is, I think, the ultimate owner of any innovation, and I'll come back to this in just a minute on the consumer. But anyone that is an inventor and anyone that is a regulator on whether that's a housing practice, a packaging practice, or a new product that goes into feed, the inventor and the regulator need to be the accountable owners and need to assure people like you of no surprises. And I think this is something that I'll raise my hand and say, as an innovator in the meat industry, we've not done a very good job of. But by gosh, I can say our company, and I know other companies are saying, we must do better in the future. Because if we need innovation, you got a day-to-day job of moving and selling meat. We got to be able to lead and handle this. So that leads to the big, juicy, in-the-middle topic of choice, the need for choice. And I'll start with this and say there's 6 corners to the debate in food and technology and choice. And I would say it always has started in the science corner for us. 23 years in this company, I spent 17, 18 years in the science corner. We were dead right. I was dead right running Europe when antibiotics were an issue. And by gosh, we were scientifically dead right. We didn't talk about any other issues. And a lot of those technologies were banned and are gone. And I would challenge to say an irradiation or something else could be very much the same way. We have to go to the economic, the environmental, the moral, the consumer, and the animal well-being corner like we never had before. Because I think we've got great stories in each one of those. But we can't be scared and be politically correct and stay just in the comfortable corner, whether that's science or economics. We've got to be able to go to all 6 corners of the debate. Not necessarily being an upstate New York farm boy. I don't know, you know, my dad would love me sharing all kinds of political slides here, but I think this quote here from Senator Moynihan is a good one, that I think we're all entitled to our own opinion. We're all entitled to choice even. But I think we need to be careful to say, hey, we're not all entitled to our own facts. So, choice is a consumer right. We need to give consumers everything they want. And I will tell you that I meet with our innovation teams every day, And I would say that we've got to be able to handle, as we say, from you know, Rwanda to Boston, what the consumers want and what you need, we got to be able to find a way. We bought an enzyme company last year to say we've got to be able to find new, innovative, different ways and new spaces that are green to traditional to make sure we help you be more competitive tomorrow than you are today. Choice is important. You're the experts on customers, so I want to be very careful here. What I'll just share is a few pieces of data, but what I will say is we're constantly asking customers all the time. Del Holzer from our team was in Europe all last week in focus groups listening to European consumers, what they want, what they don't want in food as we're starting to back in our chain innovate. We had a team of about 10 people over there. We're constantly trying to even work with you and work with your teams to understand, and I think we all need to have a lot of collaboration here. Here is a study. We looked at every study done on food the last 10 years. We're updating this study right now. But this looked at the last 10 years, and we looked at two criteria that came from economists and consumer experts. And there may be differing opinions here, but to get the strongest opinion from the panels we had, they said you got to ask an unaided question. So any study done over 10 years that had an unaided question on technology and food, or give me your card from your retailer, where you spend your money. If I go into your house, or I go into Shanghai, China, or I go into South Africa, those two things are the best criteria to really understand what global consumers want. Maybe not in a niche, or maybe not, but that's at a high level. We went out, we looked at 110 studies about, and 28 met that criteria, and 26 countries, about 100,000 consumers. And candidly, we were a little underwhelmed with this. We actually went out and validated with Nielsen and others, but here's what we found. At a high level, globally, 10 years, 95% were food buyers. They wanted taste, cost, nutrition. I like this brand, it tastes good. I want to know the calories and I want to know the cost. And then there was a segment, 4%, that this could be a whole geography. It could be a suburb of Boston or Indianapolis, or it could be a category. So it's not mutually exclusive, where money didn't matter. I want local, I want organic, I want natural. Now, again, I'm going to give a disclaimer. You all, I know I'm generalizing, but what I'd say is we had a panel and economists looking at this at a very high level. The message really is 99%, the majority of the consumers, want to taste, cost, nutrition, and some choice. Now, you all double, triple click on all this data. But what did come out was there is a small group, and it is a small group, that food has become so social to them that it's become political, to where the job is now to say, I want my choice to be a choice for everybody and to take choice away. And the challenge here is that small fringe that turns a choice and takes a choice away has had and going to have bigger ramifications than it's ever had in the past. And so I think this is a challenge to say this is a small voice that we need to continue to step back and ask sometimes when we get consumer data, is this a luxury segment or is this the fringe? And that's a question that we're asking, and I would ask that we'd like to have more dialogue with you. But when a minority position becomes a state proposition that becomes a different way that impacts your bottom line and the regulator itself hasn't weighed in on it, I think that's an issue. That doesn't say that if there's a minority group that says there's something wrong with this, we call the regulator then and challenge them. Freedom of voice is very important. We went to Nielsen and validated and asked questions, bought questions on a monthly basis, as a lot of you do, and we saw very similar in terms of what was important to consumers and how many people absolutely took a personal stand politically on food, and it validated this 99% or close to it in terms of taste, cost, and nutrition. So what are we doing? Trying to change the discussion. Trying to put the focus on food security and nutrition, healthy animals, and animal well-being. So this is a little bit of kind of inside our strategy is these are the three kind of platforms of discussion. I'd like to move now a little bit from offense to defense and to talk about a capability that I think we all need to have in this room, and some of you have it well and have taught us. But if innovators or the inventor and the regulator need to be the accountable ones on innovation, I think being able to monitor what's going on has never been more important. We have over 15 screens that we monitor, like a lot of you, what's going on out there. And what we're learning is the evening news matters a lot less. Social media matters a lot more. Here's an example of a long period of time looking at antibiotics. And we're monitoring antibiotics and big agriculture and animal well-being and beta agonists. And I think this is something that constantly looking every day for us, some of our team members, what's the cloud out there and where media is and where is it hitting is important. And being able to have a good pulse on where we are. Let me unpack this a little bit. We had an example of where there was a real concern in a part of the world about antibiotics, part of the country. And there was a question and there was a very close to a decision, being vulnerable here. And during that period of time, on mentions per day, the bottom bar was this worry about a consumers union campaign against antibiotics, and it is major press. And it was in the hundreds per day. At the same time, we shared and monitored and said, hey, take a look. They wanted to know if it had repeated back later in at the end of the year. And we compared it to, hey, at the time, Twinkies and bacon are, 10, 20x. And I would say that sharing some stuff in perspective has allowed, candidly, a lot of, I think, crises from being overreactions in big positions at this stage. But I think this is something that's going to need to become a built-in capability as we go longer term. This is something I haven't shared much, but as you look at finely textured lean beef and looking at that kind of through a rear-view lens, and I don't want to sit here and say that, hey, something could have been changed or avoided or whatever. I'm going to just stay at a very high level to say we have gone around all over this country and other countries and said, what can we learn from salts, irradiation, finely textured lean beef, BST, beta agonists, and getting groups of food leaders together? A few things where this monitoring and messaging is key. And I'll share the five learnings here in just a minute. But we all know that this issue broke last March. But I would tell you the monitoring systems that we're looking at and others in this room are that number of 4,000 to 5,000 a day becomes a big deal. And you can see social media is really everything. The news and everything else is a little less. 6 weeks before the issue broke, this would have hit a lot of monitoring screens if we had them in place. And if we had them in place and we had messages in place and we had the regulator in place and the regulator knew what they had to say and what the messages were and none of you in the room were surprised, I don't know. It's easy to Monday morning quarterback. But what I'd say is we have to learn from history and events like this because you know what? This was an issue last March. Some of us in this room had an issue last week. There'll be a new issue in 3 to 4 weeks from now. And I think this becomes a new part of how we do business. And I think holding people accountable like Elanco in this area is absolutely essential. And maybe it's a packaging company and a genetics company or whatever. This is absolutely essential for the future, I believe. So our summary after all these roundtables is these 5 points. One, kind of our learnings from the food chain and innovation. The inventor and the innovator, they own the innovation. You got a job to do, that is raise high-quality meat at an affordable price. You need innovation to be affordable. You need certain growing practices to be affordable, or your farmers do. Those innovators and those regulators need to be the ones making your job easier. There should be no surprises. No surprises for any retailers. So your customers, the retailers in the room, no one should be caught off guard. Constant monitoring and appropriate response. Attempt not to make a permanent decision during the storm was a constant theme we heard from many people that have been through the storms, and including Europe and Asia, and alignment across the chain. So we're not trying to make this simple. I'm not trying to make this less complex than it is or say that we figured it out because we sure have not. But I do think that the last thing we want to do is say, hey, we just lost another $12 a head innovation. Hey, we just lost another way to raise the animal. Hey, our farmers are a little less productive, because I'm a little concerned if that occurs as I look through a lens such as the UK. The last is globalization. You know this. I don't need to get into this, but the need for trade, the opportunity for trade is key. I was in two countries in January, Dubai, and Puerto Rico for different industry food meetings. And what I will tell you is both of those countries need over 90% importation. And in 2050, they're going to still need probably 90%. And it's the right thing economically and environmentally. Meat and milk and eggs must move. And we know that. I don't need to spend a lot of time. I'll share this slide. I'm just sharing this because I think this is important. We've been called to Argentina 3 or 4 times. We're an American-based company, but we operate globally like a lot of you do. We were called last year to Argentina, and they have a very aggressive agricultural ministry, and they threw a book on the table in English on my desk. They asked me to come, flew down there, went in, and it was a 2020 report. And their bottom line is, hey, by 2020, we're a population of 40 million, we feed 400 million. And we want to feed by 2020, 650 million. And you have 4 technologies that you offer the rest of the world that you don't offer us. And those 4 technologies, we believe, will feed between 20 and 30 million. And they got out a book with data. And I sat looking at my team members like, hey, are you in on this? And they had done their homework, the country. And my one point is, hey, one, there's countries like America and Argentina that can feed the rest of the world. The other is, I think playing offense and determining food gaps and food opportunities is becoming something that's an opportunity. And I think that we need to continue to remember this is a global competitive world. And every time we say no to something, how are we doing relative to other industries? And you know that. But I share this as a personal example with me. I'll tell you, a lot of politics, a lot of challenges there. But this is a real life. We're getting now countries, Vietnam, Cambodia, saying, what if, India, what if with these technologies, how many more people could we feed? What's the food gap in our country in 2050? How do we close that gap? So in summary, I believe, I'm confident that there will be a food secure world. There will be a global IQ that's greater. There'll be a lot more people eating meat and milk. We will be able to solve this fast growing. Just think about that. The next 20 years, no one on earth will have seen middle class grow as fast as us. And they're going to want meat, milk, and eggs. And we're in the industry, in the top country in the world that can do it better than anybody else. If there's a graduate getting ready to leave school, why in the world wouldn't they come into this industry? Are we ready to lead? Are we ready? And I believe these are the 3 things that we must protect. These are the 3 things we must lead to make a difference in this space. What do I do? I can't tell this room what to do, but I'll share. This is a slide we share with a lot of different food groups, agricultural groups. So this is more just FYI. I don't think necessarily I'm going to give this room direction. I hope you believe more in what you believe, and I hope you've got an idea or an opportunity, or you strongly disagree with something I said, but it convicts you to push forward. But I think refreshing our purpose on a regular basis is key. There's nothing that I think has jolted our company more to ask 3,000 people to stand behind a camera and tell them what their why is. I think in engaging in a conversation, I learned when we acquired BST, there was 11 names on a board in a food chain. Those 11 names mattered to whether biotechnology would ever stay in animal agriculture again or not. And Mike McCarty and other people and people in roles like Dell's and mine, we learned that a few names matter in this chain. So I always tell anyone I can, who are the 5 names that matter in your circle of influence that matter around this message we've talked about today? And lastly is, you know, what moves are we making to be more competitive tomorrow than today? And my challenge is, are you challenging partners like us to play harder and more aggressive? If you need a green product, you need an exported product, you need traceability, you demand innovators like us and partners and other partners to help you. I think that leverage is key. So I want to thank you. I want to end by saying that we're in this thing. I'm in this, and our company is, but I couldn't be more proud to be an American in the meat business, helping lead an innovation company, because the end of this story is going to be a really good one. And as I look around here, I'm just honored to say we can do this together, and appreciate the opportunity to have a relationship and be part of the food chain with all of you. Thank you. Questions? A few questions or comments or reactions. Can I summarize the four technologies?
Yeah, they were coming to you.
Yeah.
Right.
What I'll tell you is this, and I kind of have a pact to say, when I stand on stage, I don't do any commercialization, okay? I don't do any product, unless it's product classes like antibiotics or whatever. What I would tell you is two of them were health-oriented, and two of them were productivity-oriented, and they were all four of them were in cattle, dairy and beef, as you can imagine, from Argentina. So that's, and I would say we were not the only company on their list. They actually shared with us, they had a punch list of different companies from all aspects of the food chain. So,
thank you, Jeff. Good information. How many of our elected officials, especially in Washington, you think understand this, as opposed to they have a belief that stuff just happens and they don't really have to worry about these kind of things like we do?
Yeah, what I'd say is, I'll answer with this. I have a 500 list. So the BST example I shared with 11, was one of our business cases we looked at, like finely textured lean beef. We had 11 names. Well, I've got 500 globally, and my answer to you is that there's a lot of those 500. And that's a global list, and we think these are the people that are absolutely, I believe there's 500 people that absolutely must know. So when a crisis hits or we're introducing a new technology, that these 500 people are pro-aware or not surprised. And what I would say is inside the loop in Washington, there's a large number on that list that are represented there that we feel like need to better understand. No question. I mean, and that's a constantly changing environment. And, with the politics, you get somebody that's only in there in a 3 to 4 year period or whatever, it's absolutely critical. You know, the number two guy in the health organization that's in charge of food safety and is shaping a policy on antibiotics, I not only am with him, but I'm talking, I'm back and forth texting him, because if we're one of the major companies in antibiotics, we need to be, for all of you, be aware and be connected. I think that's essential. So Washington, there's a large number, and I think it's all of our job.
You can talk that person, but an elected official doesn't care about the science.
No.
They care about being...
They do. They care about being elected. And look, there's some trend I didn't mention, and that is urbanization. Urbanization of the world, especially the United States, I think we all know, urbanization has changed politics. Urbanization has changed the colors of the districts. And it's definitely not necessarily those that best understand agriculture. So the voting shift has gone urban. Food is not necessarily in that space. That trend is, I'd say, the middle class trend is exciting. The one trend that scares me the most is the urbanization of the world relative to food and policy. All right, we'll be here, so be more than welcome to have one-on-one conversations. Again, thank you very much for the partnership. Business. Thanks.